The 22nd was the great day on Thursday Island, for then we had not only his diamond jubilee, but a jubilee with a grand corroboree in it, Mr. Douglas having brought some 400 native warriors and their wives and children across from the mainland to give the celebration the true native touch, for when they do a thing on Thursday Island, they do it with a roar. The corroboree was, at any rate, a howling success. It took place at night, and the performers, painted in fantastic colors, danced or leaped about before a blazing fire. Some were rigged and painted like birds and beasts, in which the emu and kangaroo were well represented. One fellow leaped like a frog. Some had the human skeleton painted on their bodies, while they jumped about threateningly, spear in hand, ready to strike down some imaginary enemy. The kangaroo hopped and danced with natural ease and grace, making a fine figure. All kept time to music, vocal and instrumental, the instruments being bits of wood which they beat against one another, and saucer-like bones held in the palm of the hands which they knocked together, making a dull sound. It was a show at once amusing, spectacular, and hideous. On June 24, the Spray, well fitted in every way, sailed for the long voyage ahead down the Indian Ocean. The Spray had now passed nearly all the dangers of the Coral Sea and Torres Strait, which indeed were not a few, and all ahead from this point was plain sailing in a straight course. The trade wind was still blowing fresh, and could be counted on safely now down to the coast of Madagascar, if not beyond that, for it was still early in the season. I had no wish to arrive off the Cape of Good Hope before midsummer, and it was now early winter. And so, with time enough before me to admit of a run ashore in the islands en route, I shaped the course now for Keeling Cocos, Atoll Islands, distant 2,700 miles. Taking a departure from Booby Island, which the sloop passed early in the day, I decided to sight Timor on the way, an island of high mountains. On the 25th of June, the sloop was already clear of all the shoals and dangers, and was sailing on a smooth sea as steadily as before, but with speed somewhat slackened. I got out the flying jib made at Juan Fernandez and set it as a spinnaker, and the spinnaker pulled like a sodger, and the Spray mended her pace. For several days now, the Spray sailed west on the parallel of 10 degrees 25 minutes south as true as a hair. If she deviated at all from that through the day or night, and this may have happened, she was back, strangely enough, at noon, at the same latitude. But the greatest science was in reckoning the longitude. My 10 o'clock and only timepiece had by this time lost its minute hand, but after I boiled her, she told the hours, and that was near enough on a long stretch. On the 2nd of July, the great island of Timor was in view away to the north. On the following day, I saw Dana Island, not far off, and a breeze came up from the land at night, fragrant of the spices of the coast. On the 11th, with all sails set and with the spinnaker still abroad, Christmas Island came into view, one point on the starboard bow. To the Keeling Cocos Islands was now only 550 miles, but even in this short run it was necessary to be extremely careful in keeping a true course, else I would miss the atoll. The first unmistakable sign of the land was a visit one morning from a white tern that fluttered very knowingly about the vessel, and then took itself off westward with a businesslike air in its wing. The tern is called by the islanders the pilot of Keeling Cocos. Farther on, I came among a great number of birds fishing and fighting over whatever they caught. My reckoning was up, and springing aloft, I saw from halfway up the mast coconut trees standing out of the water ahead. I expected to see this. Still, it thrilled me as an electric shock might have done. I slid down the mast, trembling under the strangest sensations, and not being able to resist the impulse, I sat on deck and gave way to my emotions. To folks in a parlor on shore, this may seem weak indeed, but I'm telling the story of a voyage alone. I didn't touch the helm, for with the current and heave of the sea, the sloop found herself at the end of the run, absolutely in the fairway of the channel. I cast anchor at 3:30 p.m., July 17, 1897, 23 days from Thursday Island. The distance run was 2,700 miles as the crow flies. This would have been a fair Atlantic voyage. It was a delightful sail. During those 23 days, I had not spent altogether more than 3 hours at the helm, including the time occupied in beating into Keeling Harbor. I just lashed the helm and let her go. Whether the wind was abeam or dead aft, it was all the same. She always sailed on her course. The Keeling Cocos Islands were discovered in 1608 by Captain William Keeling, then in the service of the East India Company. The southern group consists of 7 or 8 islands and islets on the atoll, which is the skeleton of what someday, according to the history of coral reefs, will be a continuous island. Admiral Fitzroy of the Beagle, who visited here, where many things are reversed, spoke of these singular though small islands where crabs eat coconuts, fish eat coral, dogs catch fish, men ride on turtles, and shells are dangerous man-traps, adding that the greater part of the seafowl roost on branches, and many rats make their nests in the tops of palm trees. My vessel being refitted, I decided to load her with the famous mammoth Tridacna shell of Keeling, found in the bayou nearby. The Tridacna were procured, 30 of them taking the place of 3 tons of cement ballast, which I threw overboard to make room and give buoyancy. On August 22nd, the sloop swung out to sea under all sail, heading again for home. Mounting 1 or 2 heavy rollers on the fringe of the atoll, she cleared the flashing reefs. The sea was rugged, and the spray washed heavily when hauled on the wind, which course I took for the island of Rodriguez. It was a curious thing that at all of the islands some reality was insisted on as unreal, while improbabilities were clothed as hard facts. And so it happened, on Rodriguez Island here, that the good abbey a few days before had been telling his people about the coming of Antichrist, and when they saw the spray sail into the harbor, all feather-white before a gale of wind, and run all standing upon the beach, and with only 1 man aboard, they cried,
"May the Lord help us! It is he, and he has come in a boat!"
Which I say would have been the most improbable way of his coming. Nevertheless, the news went flying through the place. The governor of the island, Mr. Roberts, came down immediately to see what it was all about, for the little town was in a great commotion. One elderly woman, when she heard of my advent, made for her house and locked herself in. When she heard that I was actually coming up the street, she barricaded her doors and did not come out while I was on the island, a period of 8 days. My first day at this land of promise was to me like a fairy tale. For many days I had studied the charts and counted the time of my arrival at this spot as one might his entrance to the islands of the blessed, looking upon it as the terminus of the last long run, made irksome by the want of many things with which, from this time on, I could keep well supplied. And behold, here was the sloop, arrived, and made securely fast to a pier in Rodriguez. On the 16th of September, after 8 restful days at Rodriguez, the mid-ocean land of plenty, I set sail, and on the 19th arrived at Mauritius, anchoring at quarantine about noon. The sloop was towed in later on the same day by the doctor's launch, after he was satisfied that I had mustered all the crew for inspection. Of this he seemed in doubt until he examined the papers, which called for a crew of 1, all told, from port to port throughout the voyage. At Mauritius, where I drew a long breath, the spray rested her wings, it being the season of fine weather. The hardships of the voyage, if there had been any, were now computed by officers of experience as 9/10 finished, and yet somehow I could not forget that the United States was still a long way off. It was winter still off stormy Cape of Good Hope, but the storms might whistle there. I determined to see it out in milder Mauritius, visiting Rose Hill, Curepepe, and other places on the island. I spent a day with the elder Mr. Roberts, father of Governor Roberts of Rodriguez, and with his friends the very Reverend Fathers O'Loughlin and McCarthy. Returning to the spray by way of the great flower conservatory near Mocha, the proprietor, having only that morning discovered a new and hardy plant, to my great honor named it Slocum, which he said Latinized it at once, saving him some trouble on the twist of a word, and the good botanist seemed pleased that I had come. How different things are in different countries. In Boston, Massachusetts at that time, a gentleman, so I was told, paid $30,000 to have a flower named after his wife, and it was not a big flower either, while Slocum, which came without the asking, was bigger than a Mangelwurzel. While at Mauritius, the spray was tendered the use of the military dock free of charge and was thoroughly refitted by the port authorities. My sincere gratitude is also due for other friends for many things needful for the voyage put on board, including bags of sugar from some of the famous old plantations. The favorable season now set in, and thus well equipped, on the 26th of October, the spray put to sea. As I sailed before a light wind, the island receded slowly, and on the following day I could still see the Puce Mountain near Mocha. The spray arrived next day off Galette, Réunion. From Réunion, I shaped a course direct for Cape St. Mary, Madagascar. On the 17th of November, she arrived at Port Natal. This delightful place is the commercial center of the garden colony, Durban itself, the city being the continuation of a garden. The signalman from the bluff station reported the spray 15 miles off. The wind was freshening, and when she was within 8 miles, he said, "The spray is shortening sail. The mainsail was reefed and set in 10 minutes. One man is doing all the work." This item of news was printed 3 minutes later in a Durban morning journal, which was handed to me when I arrived in port. I could not verify the time it had taken to reef the sail, for, as I've already said, the minute hand of my timepiece was gone. I only knew that I reefed it as quickly as I could. The same paper, commenting on the voyage, said, "Judging from the stormy weather which has prevailed off this coast during the past few weeks, the spray must have had a very stormy voyage from Mauritius to Natal." Doubtless the weather could have been called stormy by sailors in any ship, but it caused the spray no more inconvenience than the delay natural to headwinds generally. I found that Durban supported 2 yacht clubs, both of them full of enterprise. I met all the members of both clubs and sailed in the crack yacht Florence of the Royal Natal with Captain Spradbrow and the Right Honorable Harry Escombe, premier of the colony. The yacht's centerboard plowed furrows through the mud banks, which, according to Mr. Escombe, Spradbrow afterward planted with potatoes. The Florence, however, won races while she tilled the skipper's land. After our sail on the Florence, Mr. Escombe offered to sail the spray around the Cape of Good Hope for me, and hinted at his famous cribbage board to while away the hours. Spradbrow, in retort, warned me of it. Said he, "You would be played out of the sloop before you could round the Cape." It was a matter of no small pride to me in South Africa to find that American humor was never to discount, and one of the best American stories I ever heard was told by the Premier. At Hotel Royal one day, dining with Colonel Saunderson, his son, and Lieutenant Tipping, I met Mr. Stanley. The great explorer was just from Pretoria, and had already as good as flayed President Kruger with his trenchant pen. But that did not signify, for everybody has a whackadoom Paul, and no one in the world seems to stand the joke better than he, not even the Sultan of Turkey himself. The colonel introduced me to the explorer, and I hauled close to the wind to go slow, for Mr. Stanley was a nautical man once himself, and, of course, my desire was to appear in the best light before a man of his experience. He looked me over carefully and said,
"What an example of patience!"
"Patience is all that is required," I ventured to reply. He then asked if my vessel had watertight compartments. I explained that she was all watertight and all compartment.
"What if she should strike a rock?"
"Compartments would not save her if she should hit the rocks lying along her course," said I, adding, "She must be kept away from the rocks." After a considerable pause, Mr. Stanley asked,
"What if a swordfish should pierce her hull with its sword?"
Of course, I had thought of that as one of the dangers of the sea, and also of the chance of being struck by lightning. In the case of the swordfish, I ventured to say that the first thing would be to secure the sword. The colonel invited me to dine with the party on the following day that we might go further into this matter, and so I had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Stanley a second time, but got no more hints in navigation from the famous explorer. It sounds odd to hear scholars and statesmen say that the world is flat, but it is a fact that 3 boars, favored by the opinion of President Kruger, prepared a work to support that contention. While I was at Durban, they came from Pretoria to obtain data from me, and they seemed annoyed when I told them that they could not prove it by my experience. With the advice to call up some ghost of the Dark Ages for research, I went ashore and left these 3 wise men poring over the spray's track on a chart of the world, which, however, proved nothing for them, for it was on Mercator's projection, and behold, it was flat. The next morning I met one of the party in a clergyman's garb, carrying a large Bible, not different from the one I had read. He tackled me, saying,
"If you respect the word of God, you must admit that the world is flat."
"If the word of God stands on a flat world," I began.
"What?" cried he, losing himself in a passion and making as if he would run me through with an assegai. "What?" he shouted in astonishment and rage, while I jumped aside to dodge the imaginary weapon.
Had this good but misguided fanatic been armed with a real weapon, the crew of the Spray would have died a martyr there and then. The next day, seeing him across the street, I bowed and made curves with my hands. He responded with a level, swimming movement of his hands, meaning the world is flat. A pamphlet by these Transvaal geographers, made up of arguments from sources high and low to prove their story, was mailed to me before I sailed from Africa on my last stretch around the globe. While I feebly portray the ignorance of these learned men, I have great admiration for their physical manhood. Much that I saw first and last of the Transvaal and the Boers was admirable. It is well known that they are the hardest of fighters, and as generous to the fallen as they are brave before the foe. Real stubborn bigotry with them is only found among old fogies, and will die a natural death in that too, perhaps long before we ourselves are entirely free from bigotry. Education in the Transvaal is by no means neglected, English as well as Dutch being taught to all that can afford both. But the tariff duty on English school books is heavy, and from necessity the poorer people stick to the Transvaal Dutch and their flat world. But all fine things must end, and December 14, 1897, the crew of the Spray, after having a fine time in Natal, swung the sloop's dinghy in on deck and sailed with the morning land wind, which carried her clear of the bar, and again she was off on her alone, as they say in Australia. The Cape of Good Hope was now the most prominent point to pass. From Table Bay I could count on the aid of brisk trades, and then the Spray would soon be at home. On the first day out from Durban it felt calm, and I sat thinking about these things and the end of the voyage. The distance to Table Bay, where I intended to call, was about 800 miles over what might prove a rough sea. The early Portuguese navigators, endowed with patience, were more than 69 years struggling to round this cape before they got as far as Algoa Bay, and there the crew mutinied. They landed on a small island, now called Santa Cruz, where they devoutly set up the cross and swore that they would cut the captain's throat if he attempted to sail farther. Beyond this, they thought, was the edge of the world, which they too believed was flat, and fearing that their ship would sail over the brink of it, they compelled Captain Diaz, their commander, to retrace his course, all being only too glad to get home. A year later, we are told, Vasco da Gama sailed successfully around the Cape of Storms, as the Cape of Good Hope was then called, and discovered Natal on Christmas or Natal Day, hence the name. On Christmas 1897, I came to the pitch of the Cape. On this day the Spray was trying to stand on her head, and she gave me every reason to believe she would accomplish the feat before night. A large English steamer passing ran up the signal, wishing you a Merry Christmas. 2 days later, the Spray, having recovered the distance lost in the gale, passed Cape Agulhas in company with the steamship Scotsman, now with a fair wind. One more gale of wind came down upon the Spray from the west after she passed Cape Agulhas, but that one she dodged by getting into Simon's Bay. When it moderated, she beat around the Cape of Good Hope, where they say the Flying Dutchman is still sailing. The voyage then seemed as good as finished. From this time on, I knew that all, or nearly all, would be plain sailing. From the recent hard weather, the Spray ran into a calm under Table Mountain, where she lay quietly till the generous sun rose over the land and drew a breeze in from the sea. The steam tug Alert, then out looking for ships, came to the Spray and towed her into port. She came to anchor in the bay off the city of Cape Town, where she remained a day. On the following morning, the Spray sailed into the Alfred dry docks, where she remained for about 3 months in the care of the port authorities, while I traveled the country over from Simonstown to Pretoria, being accorded by the colonial government a free rail pass over all the land. His Excellency, Sir Alfred Milner, the governor, found time to come aboard with the party. Dr. David Gill, astronomer royal, who was of the party, invited me the next day to the famous Cape Observatory. An hour with Dr. Gill was an hour among the stars. He showed me the great astronomical clock of the observatory, and I showed him the tin clock on the Spray, and we went over the subject of standard time at sea, and how it was found from the deck of the little sloop without the aid of a clock of any kind. I've often been asked how it was that my vessel and all appurtenances were not stolen in the various ports where I left her for days together without a watchman in charge. This is just how it was. The Spray seldom fell among thieves. At the Keeling Islands, at Rodriguez, and at many such places, a wisp of coconut fiber in the door latch, to indicate that the owner was away, secured the goods against even a longing glance. But when I came to a great island nearer home, stout locks were needed. The first night in port, things which I had always left uncovered disappeared, as if the deck on which they were stowed had been swept by a sea. On March 26, 1898, the Spray sailed from South Africa, the land of distances and pure air, where she had spent a pleasant and profitable time. The steam tug Tiger towed her to sea, giving her a good offing. The light morning breeze, which scantily filled her sails when the tug let go the tow line, soon died away altogether, and left her riding over a heavy swell, in full view of Table Mountain and the high peaks of the Cape of Good Hope. For a while, the grand scenery served to relieve the monotony. One of the old circumnavigators, Sir Francis Drake, I think, when he first saw this magnificent pile, sang, "'Tis the fairest thing in the grandest cape I've seen in the whole circumference of the earth." I was glad to note, finally, the short heaving sea, precursor of the wind which followed on the second day. Porpoises and dolphins, and other such fishes as did not mind making 150 miles a day, were her companions now for several days. The wind was from the southeast. This suited the Spray well, and she ran along steadily at her best speed, while I dipped into the new books given me at the Cape, reading day and night. March 30th was for me a fast day in honor of them. I read on, oblivious of hunger or wind or sea, thinking that all was going well, when suddenly a comber rolled over the stern and slopped saucily into the cabin, wetting the very book I was reading. Evidently it was time to put in a reef, that she might not wallow on her course. March 31st, the fresh southeast wind had come to stay. The sloop was again doing her work smoothly, hardly rolling at all, but just leaping along among the white horses, 1,000 gambolling porpoises. She was again among her old friends, the flying fish, interesting denizens of the sea. Shooting out of the waves like arrows and with outstretched wings, they sailed on the wind in graceful curves, then falling till again they touched the crest of the waves to wet their delicate wings and renew their flight. One could not be lonely in a sea like this. Moreover, the reading of delightful adventures enhanced the scene. I was now in the Spray and on the Oise and the Arethusa at one and the same time. And so the Spray reeled off the miles, showing a good run every day till April 11th, which came almost before I knew it. Very early that morning I was awakened by that rare bird, the booby, with its harsh quack, which I recognized at once as a call to go on deck. It was as much to say, "Skipper, there's land in sight." I tumbled out quickly, and sure enough, way ahead in the dim twilight, about 20 miles off, was St. Helena. I reached for a bottle of port wine out of the locker and took a long pull from it to the health of my invisible helmsman, the pilot of the Pinta. It was about noon when the Spray came to anchor off Jamestown, and all hands at once went ashore to pay respects to His Excellency, the governor of the island, Sir R.A. Sterndale. His Excellency, when I landed, remarked that it was not often, nowadays, that a circumnavigator came his way, and he cordially welcomed me, and arranged that I should tell about the voyage, first at Garden Hall to the people of Jamestown, and then at Plantation House, the governor's residence, which is in the hills a mile or two back, to His Excellency and the officers of the garrison and their friends. Returning from the governor's house to Jamestown, I drove with Mr. Clark, a countryman of mine, to Longwood, the home of Napoleon. On the 20th of April, the Spray was again ready for sea. It was late in the evening before the anchor was up, and I bore off for the west, loath to leave my new friends. When morning came, there was no land in sight, but the day went on the same as days before, save for one small incident. Governor Sterndale had given me a bag of coffee in the husk, and Clark, the American, in an evil moment, had put a goat on board to butt the sack and hustle the coffee beans out of the pods. He urged that the animal, besides being useful, would be as companionable as a dog. I soon found that my sailing companion, this sort of dog with horns, had to be tied up entirely. The mistake I made was that I did not chain him to the mast instead of tying him with grass ropes less securely, and this I learned to my cost. Except for the first day, before the beast got his sea legs on, I had no peace of mind. After that, actuated by a spirit born maybe of his pasturage, this incarnation of evil threatened to devour everything from flying jib to stern davits. He was the worst pirate I met on the whole voyage. He began depredations by eating my chart of the West Indies in the cabin one day while I was about my work forward, thinking that the critter was securely tied on deck by the pumps. Alas, there was not a rope in the sloop proof against that goat's awful teeth. Next, the goat devoured my straw hat, and so when I arrived in port, I had nothing to wear ashore on my head. This last unkind stroke decided his fate. On the 27th of April, the Spray arrived at Ascension, which is garrisoned by a man-of-war crew, and the boatswain of the island came on board. As he stepped out of his boat, the mutinous goat climbed into it and defied boatswain and crew. I hired them to land the wretch at once, which they were only too willing to do, and there he fell into the hands of a most excellent Scotchman, with the chances that he would never get away. On the evening of April 29th, the sea having gone down, I went on board and made preparations to start again on my voyage early next day, the boatswain of the island and his crew giving me a hearty handshake as I embarked the jetty. For reasons of scientific interest, I invited in mid-ocean the most thorough investigation concerning the crew list of the Spray. Very few had challenged it, and perhaps few will ever do so henceforth. But for the benefit of the few that may, I wish to clinch beyond doubt the fact that it was not at all necessary in the expedition of a sloop around the world to have more than one man for the crew, all told, and that the Spray sailed with only one person on board. And so, by appointment, Lieutenant Eagles, the executive officer, in the morning, just as I was ready to sail, fumigated the sloop, rendering it impossible for a person to live concealed below, and proving that only one person was on board when she arrived. A certificate to this effect, besides the official documents from the many consulates, health offices, and custom houses, will seem to many superfluous. But this story of the voyage may find its way into hands unfamiliar with the business of these offices and of their ways of seeing that a vessel's papers, and above all her bills of health, are in order. The lieutenant's certificate being made out, the Spray now filled away clear of the sea-beaten rocks, and the trade winds, comfortably cool and bracing, sent her flying along her course. On May 8th, 1898, she crossed the track, homeward bound, that she had made October 2nd, 1895, on the voyage out. I felt a contentment in knowing that the Spray had encircled the globe, and even as an adventure alone, I was in no way discouraged as to its utility, and said to myself, "Let what will happen, the voyage is now on record." A period was made. On May 10, there was a great change in the condition of the sea. There could be no doubt of my longitude now, if any had before existed in my mind. Strange and long-forgotten current ripples pattered against the sloop's sides in grateful music. The tune arrested the ear, and I sat quietly listening to it while the Spray kept on her course. By these current ripples, I was assured that she was now off St. Roque and had struck the current which sweeps around that cape. The trade winds, we old sailors say, produce this current, which in its course from this point forward is governed by the coastline of Brazil, Guyana, Venezuela, and, as some would say, by the Monroe Doctrine. I saw nothing of the coast of Brazil, though I was not many leagues off and was always in the Brazil current. I did not know that the war with Spain had been declared, and that I might be liable right there to meet the enemy and be captured. Many had told me at Cape Town that, in their opinion, war was inevitable. Even in the fever heat over the disaster to the Maine, I did not think there would be war, but I'm no politician. Indeed, I'd hardly given the matter a serious thought when, on the 14th of May, just north of the equator and near the longitude of the River Amazon, I saw first a mast, with the stars and stripes floating from it, rising astern as if poked up out of the sea, and then rapidly appearing on the horizon, like a citadel, the Oregon. As she came near, I saw that the great ship was flying the signals CBT, which read, "Are there any men of war about?" Right under these flags, and larger than the Spray's mainsail, so it appeared, was the yellowest Spanish flag I ever saw. It gave me nightmares some time after, when I reflected on it in my dreams. I did not make out the Oregon signals till she passed ahead, where I could read them better, for she was 2 miles away and I had no binoculars. When I'd read her flags, I hoisted the signal, no, for I had not seen any Spanish men of war. I had not been looking for any. My final signal, let us keep together for mutual protection, Captain Clark did not seem to regard as necessary. Perhaps my small flags were not made out. Anyhow, the Oregon steamed on with a rush, looking for Spanish men of war, as I learned afterward. I pondered long that night over the probability of a war risk now coming upon the Spray after she had cleared all, or nearly all, of the dangers at sea, but finally a strong hope mastered my fears. On the 17th of May, the Spray, coming out of a storm at daylight, made Devil's Island, 2 points on the lee bow, not far off. I could clearly see the dark gray buildings on the island as the sloop brought it abeam. No flag or sign of life was seen on the dreary place. On May 18, 1898, is written large in the Spray's logbook, tonight, in latitude 7 degrees 13 minutes north, for the first time in nearly 3 years, I see the North Star. The Spray on the day following logged 147 miles. To this I add 35 miles for current sweeping her onward. On the 20th of May, about sunset, the island of Tobago, off the Orinoco, came into view, bearing west by north, distant 22 miles. The Spray was drawing rapidly toward her home destination. Later at night, while running free along the coast of Tobago, the wind still blowing fresh, I was startled by the sudden flash of breakers on the port bow and not far off. I luffed instantly offshore and then tacked, heading in for the island. Finding myself shortly after close in with the land, I tacked again offshore, but without much altering the bearings of the danger. Sail whichever way I would, it seemed clear that if the sloop weathered the rocks at all, it would be a close shave, and I watched with anxiety while beating against the current, always losing ground. So the matter stood hour after hour, while I watched the flashes of light thrown up as regularly as the beats of the long ocean swells, and always they seemed just a little nearer. It was evidently a coral reef, and a bad reef at that. Worse still, there might be other reefs ahead forming a bight into which the current would sweep me, and where I should be hemmed in and finally wrecked. I had not sailed these waters since a lad, and lamented the day I had allowed on board the goat that ate my chart. I taxed my memory of sea lore, of wrecks on sunken reefs, and of pirates harbored among coral reefs where other ships might not come, but nothing that I could think of applied to the island of Tobago, save the one wreck of Robinson Crusoe's ship in the fiction, and that gave me little information about reefs. "But there she booms again," I cried, "and how close the flash is now. Almost aboard was that last breaker. But you'll go by, Spray, old girl. 'Tis a beam now. One surge more, and, oh, one more like that will clear your ribs and keel." And I slapped her on the transom, proud of her last noble effort to leap clear of the danger, when a wave greater than the rest threw her higher than before, and, behold, from the crest of it was revealed at once all there was of the reef. I fell back in a coil of rope, speechless and amazed, not distressed, but rejoiced. My fisherman's own lantern. It was the great revolving light on the island of Trinidad, 30 miles away, throwing flashes over the waves which had deceived me. The orb of light was now dipping on the horizon, and how glorious was the sight of it. Through all the rest of the night I saw imaginary reefs, and not knowing what moment the sloop might fetch up on a real one, I tacked off and on till daylight, as nearly as possible on the same track, all for the want of a chart. I could have nailed the St. Helena's goat's pelt to the deck. My course was now for Grenada, to which I carried letters from Mauritius. About midnight of the 22nd of May, I arrived at the island and cast anchor in the roads off the town of St. George, entering the inner harbor at daylight on the morning of the 23rd, which made 42 days sailing from the Cape of Good Hope. It was a good run, and I doffed my cap again to the pilot of the Pinta. The Spray sailed from Grenada on the 28th of May and coasted along under the lee of the Antilles, arriving at the island of Dominica on the 30th, where, for the want of knowing better, I cast anchor at the quarantine ground, for I was still without a chart of the islands, not having been able to get one even at Grenada. Here I met with further disappointment in the matter, and made all sail for St. John, Antigua, where I arrived on the 1st of June, having sailed with great caution in mid-channel all the way. On the 4th of June, 1898, the Spray cleared from the United States Consulate, and her license to sail single-handed, even round the world, was returned to her for the last time. The United States Consul, Mr. Hunt, before handing the paper to me, wrote on it, as General Roberts had done at Cape Town, a short commentary on the voyage. The document, by regular course, is now lodged in the Treasury Department at Washington, D.C. On June 5th, 1898, the Spray sailed for a home port, heading first direct for Cape Hatteras. The Spray was booming joyously along for home now, making her usual good time, when of a sudden she struck the horse latitudes, and her sail flapped limp in a calm. I'd almost forgotten this calm belt, or had come to regard it as a myth. I found it real now, however, and difficult to cross. This was as it should have been, for, after all the dangers of the sea, the dust storm on the coast of Africa, the rain of blood in Australia, and the war risk when nearing home, a natural experience would have been missing had the calm of the horse latitudes been left out. Anyhow, a philosophical turn of thought now was not amiss, else one's patience would have given out almost at the harbor entrance. The term of her probation was 8 days. Evening after evening during this time, I read by the light of a candle on deck. There was no wind at all, and the sea became smooth and monotonous. For 3 days I saw a full-rigged ship on the horizon, also becalmed. Sargasso, scattered over the sea in bunches, or trailed curiously along down the wind in narrow lanes, now gathered together in great fields. Strange sea animals, little and big, swimming in and out, the most curious among them being a tiny seahorse, which I captured and brought home preserved in a bottle. But on the 18th of June, a gale began to blow from the southwest, and the Sargasso was dispersed again in windrows and lanes. On this day there was soon wind enough, and to spare. The same might have been said of the sea. The Spray was in the midst of the turbulent Gulf Stream itself. She was jumping like a porpoise over the uneasy waves. As if to make up for lost time, she seemed to touch only the high places. Under a sudden shock and strain, her rigging began to give out. First, the mainsheet strap was carried away, and then the peak halyard block broke from the gaff. It was time to reef and refit, and so when all hands came on deck, I went about doing that. The 19th of June was fine, but on the morning of the 20th, another gale was blowing, accompanied by cross seas that tumbled about and shook things up with great confusion. Just as I was thinking about taking in sail, the jibstay broke at the masthead and fell, jib and all, into the sea. It gave me the strangest sensation to see the bellying sail fall, and where it had been, suddenly to see only space. However, I was at the bows with presence of mind to gather it in on the first wave that rolled up before it was torn or trailed under the sloop's bottom. I found by the amount of work done in 3 minutes or less time that I had by no means grown stiff-jointed on the voyage. Anyhow, scurvy had not set in, and being now within a few degrees of home, I might complete the voyage, I thought, without the aid of a doctor. Yes, my health was still good, and I could skip about the decks in a lively manner, but could I climb? The great King Neptune tested me severely at this time, for the stay being gone, the mast itself switched about like a reed and was not easy to climb. But a gun-tackle purchase was got up, and the stay set taut from the masthead, for I had spare blocks and rope on board with which to rig it, and the jib, with a reef in it, was soon pulling again like a sodger for home. On the 23rd of June, I was at last tired, tired, tired of baffling squalls and fretful cobble seas. I had not seen a vessel for days and days, where I had expected the company of at least a schooner now and then. As to the whistling of the wind through the rigging and the slopping of the sea against the sloop sides, that was well enough in its way, and we could have not gone on without it, the Spray and I. But there was so much of it now, and it lasted so long. At noon of that day, a winterish storm was upon us from the northwest. In the Gulf Stream, thus late in June, hailstones were pelting the Spray, and lightning was pouring down from the clouds, not in flashes alone, but
in almost continuous streams. By slants, however, day and night, I worked the sloop in toward the coast, where, on the 25th of June, off Fire Island, she fell into the tornado which, an hour earlier, had swept over New York City with lightning that wrecked buildings and sent trees flying about in splinters. Even ships at docks had parted their moorings and smashed into other ships, doing great damage. It was the climax storm of the voyage, but I saw the unmistakable character of it in time to have all snug aboard and receive it under bare poles. Even so, the sloop shivered when it struck her, and she heeled over unwillingly on her beam ends. But rounding to with a sea anchor ahead, she righted and faced out the storm. In the midst of a gale, I could do no more than look on, for what is a man in a storm like this? Up to this time, I was bound for New York, but when all was over, I rose, made sail, and hove the sloop round from starboard to port tack to make for a quiet harbor to think the matter over. And so, under short sail, she reached in for the coast of Long Island, while I sat thinking and watching the lights of coasting vessels which now began to appear in sight. Reflections of the voyage so nearly finished stole in upon me now. Many tunes I had hummed again and again came back once more. After this storm, I saw the pilot of the Pinta no more. The experiences of the voyage of the Spray, reaching over 3 years, had been to me like reading a book, and one that was more and more interesting as I turned the pages, till I had come now to the last page of all, and the one more interesting than any of the rest. When daylight came, I saw that the sea had changed color from dark green to light. I threw the lead and got soundings in 13 fathoms. I made the land soon after, some miles east of Fire Island, and sailing thence before a pleasant breeze along the coast, made for Newport. The weather, after the furious gale, was remarkably fine. The Spray rounded Montauk Point early in the afternoon. Point Judith was abeam at dark. She fetched in at Beaver Tail next. Sailing on, she had one more danger to pass. Newport Harbor was mined. The Spray hugged the rocks along where neither friend nor foe could come if drawing much water, and where she would not disturb the guardship in the channel. It was close work, but it was safe enough so long as she hugged the rocks close and not the mines. Flitting by a low point abreast of the guardship, the dear old Dexter, which I knew well, someone on board of her sang out,
"There goes a craft!"
I threw up a light at once and heard the hail,
"Spray ahoy!"
It was the voice of a friend, and I knew that a friend would not fire on the Spray. I eased off the main sheet now, and the Spray swung off for the beacon lights of the inner harbor. At last she reached the port in safety, and there at 1 a.m. on June 27th, 1898, cast anchor, after the cruise of more than 46,000 miles round the world, during an absence of 3 years and 2 months, with 2 days over for coming up. Was the crew well? Was I not? I had profited in many ways by the voyage. I had even gained flesh, and actually weighed a pound more than when I sailed from Boston. As for aging, why, the dial of my life was turned back till my friends all said, "Slocum is young again." And so I was, at least 10 years younger than the day I felled the first tree for the construction of the Spray. My ship was also in better condition than when she sailed from Boston on her long voyage. She was still as sound as a nut and as tight as the best ship afloat. She did not leak a drop, not one drop. The pump, which had been little used before reaching Australia, had not been rigged since that at all. The first name on the Spray's visitor's book in the home port was written by the one who always said, "The Spray will come back." The Spray was not quite satisfied till I sailed her around to her birthplace, Fairhaven, Massachusetts, farther along. I had myself a desire to return to the place of the very beginning, whence I had, as I have said, renewed my age. So on July 3rd, with a fair wind, she waltzed beautifully around the coast and up the Acushnet River to Fairhaven, where I secured her to the cedar spile driven in the bank to hold her when she was launched. I could bring her no nearer home. If the spray discovered no continents on her voyage, it may be that there were no more continents to be discovered. She did not seek new worlds or sail to powwow about the dangers of the seas. The sea has been much maligned. To find one's way to lands already discovered is a good thing, and the spray made the discovery that even the worst sea is not so terrible to a well-appointed ship. And now, without having wearied my friends, I hope, with detailed scientific accounts, theories, or deductions, I will only say that I have endeavored to tell just the story of the adventure itself. This, in my own poor way, having been done, I now moor ship, weather-bit cables, and leave the sloop Spray for the present, safe in port. An epilogue. Following his epic voyage, Captain Joshua Slocum spent the remaining years of his life as a footloose wanderer. He continued to give his lectures wherever it would pay and would exhibit himself and the ever-faithful Spray at sideshows and exhibitions. Or, failing that, he might haul an occasional cargo in order to make ends meet. However, he was never able to successfully capitalize on the fame his courageous voyage had brought him. Both Slocum and the Spray began to show their advancing age as they drifted from port to port, from the Caribbean to New England. Impoverished and usually hard up for funds, Slocum continued to plan great sailing adventures, including a voyage to Antarctica and one up the Amazon River. Alas, these expeditions were no more than the grand dreams of a man who, in his prime, had been a brave and tenacious confronter of life, who had stood up to the worst of elements and weathered whatever the world might offer to him. His Yankee tough heart and soul that had served him so well upon the seas now became worn by the rigors of time. Finally, 10 long years after his sensational voyage, Captain Joshua Slocum and the Spray set sail from Martha's Vineyard, bound for the Bahamas. It was, however, to be their last voyage, for it was never known if they made their final port of call. Perhaps Slocum decided to return to one of the idyllic islands he had encountered on his epic voyage to live out the few years left to him. Perhaps he set out on one last great adventure. Perhaps he was simply lost at sea. We will never know.